Between DDG and soybean meal, we have the two largest volume ingredients in the United States for the livestock industries. And they are direct competitors, although it's interesting because if you look at the composition, they're different. Soybean meal and corn are very complementary in terms of amino acids and fatty acids. And DDG and soybean meal are also very complementary.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge. Best Mix's industry-specific software supports feed and pet food producers in their daily challenges. Focus on your core job and let Best Mix do the rest.
Hello and welcome to this Feed Science podcast brought to you by Wisenetics. Today we are going to be visiting with Dr. Kurt Rosentrater, and we're going to learn about some DDGs. So, Dr. Rosentrater, I just ask you introduce yourself, give us a little background.
Yeah, thank you very much for the invitation to join you today. It's a pleasure to share ideas with you, things I know, things I don't know, and questions. I have a lot of questions. I grew up in Iowa. I grew up on a traditional corn, soybean, beef, and swine farm, and spent every day after school scooping manure, and that was, and carrying feed buckets, and that was my training in life. And you know what? There's a lot of philosophy in that. And after I graduated from high school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I had a bunch of FFA friends throughout Iowa that went to Iowa State. And so I came down here and kind of wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do, but I meandered my way to the ag engineering department and I was hooked. So I found a way to do math and science and agriculture all in one. And I've been hooked ever since. So I stayed at Iowa State for my bachelor's and then my master's and then my PhD work. However, at one point I did, during my graduate school, I started working for Todd & Sargent, which is a design build company where they design and construct grain elevators, feed mills, flour mills, pet food plants, biodiesel plants, and ethanol plants. So I actually got a chance to do some things in the real world. And after I finished my PhD, which was a part-time gig for me, I decided I'd try my hand at teaching. So I taught at Northern Illinois University for several years in their engineering and manufacturing program. And then I left Northern and went to South Dakota, worked at South Dakota State University, and worked at USDA Ag Research Service. And I was a research scientist devoted to DDG work. And that really has been my baptism by fire, if you will. And it was really funny because when I met my national program leader, who was my boss, I had no idea what it was I was supposed to do at USDA. And he said to me, meet the industry, find out what the problems are, and solve the problems. And it was a wide open net. And so, which was really great because it was learning anything and everything about DDG as a feed product, but also as a manufactured product, from the chemistry to the physical properties and flowability issues, as well as how do you use DDG best? Because when I joined USDA, this was back before the ethanol boom. So there were still a lot of questions about how do you feed a high fiber ingredient with fermented protein? How do you feed that to pigs and cows and chickens and turkeys? And, oh, hey, by the way, we've got more than 10 million tons. How are we going to feed all of this material? Well, let's look at fish and pets and other applications. So it really was a lot of fun figuring out what is DDG and how is it similar, how is it different amongst the different ethanol plants, and how do you use it best. But sadly, Iowa State called me up one day and said, hey, we've got an opening. Would you be interested in coming down? And so I came and talked to the folks at Iowa State, and I've been here ever since. So I continue my DDG work. I Do a lot of other things too in terms of research and teaching and outreach. Partly for almost 10 years, I was executive director of Distillers Grains Technology Council, but I hung my hat up there because there's just so much work to do in other aspects of the industry, as well as teaching the next generation of people to work at the processing plants and work at the feed yards and work at all sorts of aspects in agriculture. So that's the Reader's Digest version. For the people that are listening that remember Reader's Digest, it is still published.
You know, it's good from as a more mature person in feed. It's good to see a guy who's got some actual experience and some hands-on stuff, you know, then working into a way of also teaching and sharing. And I think that's a very good combination and not one you see everywhere. So with that said, why don't we go right into this? And why don't you give us some insight on what role that the corn ethanol industry plays in the feed industry? And, you know, I'm thinking you and I both saw a time when it came, DDGs went from a byproduct to really now to a commodity. So how did you see that happen?
That is such an interesting question because I just remember a few weeks ago, I was watching some of the retrospective news stories about 9/11 and the terrorist attacks. And I just remember back in those days, we didn't really know where the challenges were going to come from. But, oh, by the way, we import 2/3 of our fuel, 2/3 of our oil. This is a problem for national security. And it was really a mission that we had here in the United States. If you were doing research at all related to agriculture or engineering, how can we produce our own fuel? How can we reduce our reliance on imported oil and petroleum? And so I don't know if you remember seeing George Bush give his State of the Union address once upon a time. I think it was 2007, where we're going to make biofuels out of wood chips and switchgrass and all sorts of things. Uh-huh. The Energy Security Act of 2005 and 2007, which is the Renewable Fuel Standards 1 and 2, really set the stage for this exponential growth in corn-based ethanol. We went from less than 1 million gallons a year before 9/11 to 15 billion gallons per year. When did we hit that? 2012, I believe it was, maybe 2013. And, you know, the industry keeps growing. But from a feed standpoint, we went from having corn readily available to all of a sudden a majority of corn, or at least 30 to 40%, depending where you're located in the U.S., being used to make ethanol. And so nutritionists had to figure out what is the best way to use DDG instead of corn in diets. And it wasn't always easy. And it was really intriguing because it was 2005, I believe, when the industry was just starting to grow. Everyone was worried about the 10 million ton question. What are we going to do with 10 million tons of DDG? We don't know how to use all that. We're going to have to burn it or landfill it. And it's so funny looking back on that because, you know, we produce over 30 million metric tons a year. And we also produce a lot of distiller's oil that is being pulled out of the process and then sold as energy sources for poultry and other diets. But then we're also seeing the growth in the industry of concentrated proteins and yeast proteins. And the industry is so dynamic. It just because we've hit the 15 billion gallons per year of corn-based ethanol, the industry isn't stagnant. It keeps evolving and keeps changing. And so when we think about using DDG, and there's still a lot of traditional DDG, although DDG nowadays has lower fat content compared to what it was 20 years ago, because almost every ethanol plant is spinning the oil out to some degree and selling that separately. But if you think about using a DDG product in beef, dairy, swine, or poultry, it's really incredible how much we can use. And I think it's become accepted, like you said, on a commodity level. Do we use DDG, or do we use soybean meal, or do we use corn, or do we use a combination of all of those? It's in most cases, it's least cost formulation that dictates whether DDG goes in or out. And unfortunately, one of the biggest challenges in terms of formulating is exports. We ship about a third of our DDG out of the U.S. to other countries. Canada and Mexico are two of the largest, but we send a lot to the Far East, Vietnam, Indonesia, some to China, not so much anymore because of various trade disputes. But it's really the export market and the demand that dictate the price of DDG. So a lot of companies are quite interested in getting more value for that corn kernel that comes into that plant, which is why you see several companies. I think we've got more than a dozen at the moment in the U.S. that are doing some type of process to concentrate protein and sell traditional DDG, distiller's oil, but also some type of a high protein product, or maybe a suite of high protein products. So the industry keeps changing. It's never a dull moment.
That does tie into my second question too. As a swine producer who's used DDGs since they came on the scene, and you know, we were all concerned when basically ethanol's turned Iowa into an importer of corn instead of an exporter of corn. I think in my own head, I've come to realize that ethanol plants don't really consume the corn; they just take some of the stuff out of it and then put it back in the market. But in the early years, with the oil in it, as you said, and some of the other factors, it was a different kind of product for us than it is today. So if we could, let's look a little bit about, you know, the evolution of it, the taking out of the oil and the higher, certainly the higher protein. You know, can you talk a little bit about how that's displaced some soybean meal and how it, you know, DDG seems to be continuing to take a larger part of the ration?
I think you're hitting the nail on the head. Between DDG and soybean meal, we have the two largest volume ingredients in the United States for the livestock industries. And they are direct competitors, although it's interesting because if you look at the composition, they're different. Soybean meal and corn are very complementary in terms of amino acids and fatty acids. And DDG and soybean meal are also very complementary. So it's not as simple as just saying we're going to take one out and use more of the other because of the amino acid and the fatty acid balance that we have to worry about for animal production. But in the good old days, we'll call it the good old days, 20 years ago, the DDG, it's interesting because if you look at the marketplace, it is not just a single type of product. So DDG, or distillers dried grains, or DDGS, distillers dried grains with solubles, or wet cake, or distillers wet grains, or modified distillers wet grains, or just the solubles. Maybe they're wet, maybe they're dry. There are a suite of products that ethanol plants can make, but depending on where you're located, really dictates, do you produce all of those or just one or two? So for example, the feed yards in Nebraska, most of the ethanol plants don't have drying systems because they feed wet cake or a modified wet cake, which makes the cost of the byproduct really inexpensive compared to a dried product like DDG or DDGS. In Iowa, though, you know, most places will have some small quantity of wet cake that you can purchase, but most is going to be dried into a DDGS. But if you look at USDA statistics, it's a really convoluted picture because there are all of these products available in the marketplace. It's just not everywhere. So, for example, where I was in South Dakota, there was a plant that we used to go to all the time to get syrup because they sold syrup directly to the feeders there. Well, they don't sell syrup anymore because they installed centrifuges to pull oil out. And so now they just have wet cake, DDGS, which they ship out on rail, and then That's it. So I think the interesting thing that I noticed was even 20 years ago, ethanol plants were trying to look at ways to not just improve the feed materials they make, the DDGS and the wet cake, but how can we optimize ethanol production and how can we really extract value out of the corn that we're bringing into the plant. And so even 20 years ago, plants were starting to experiment with centrifugation systems that they would bring in on skids and see if they could extract the oil or separate the oil out of stillage. And the first couple of years where companies were experimenting with that, I remember being at conferences and some of the poultry feeders were at these conferences and they said, hey, don't you dare take our energy. If you take that oil, then your product has no energy. What's the point of us using DDG in our formulations anymore? Well, the interesting thing is it wasn't nutrition that was the impetus. It was the biodiesel market or the potentially growing biodiesel market that was really interesting back then. And then back in 2012, when we saw all of the ethanol plants start to install the centrifugation systems, it happened within a year. There were 85% of the plants pulling oil out. And then within 2 years, by 2013, 98% of the ethanol plants in the U.S. were pulling oil out. And it wasn't the biodiesel market anymore. It was the animal nutrition market. And now things come full circle with the way that renewable fuels, especially sustainable aviation fuels, which are coming into the marketplace, and biodiesel and renewable diesel, the oil market is a hot market. And so most of the oil that's being pulled out is really going into a multitude of markets now. It's not just nutrition, but it's also fuels. So it's a fun industry to work in, but there's never a dull moment for sure. But then we can further, there have been companies for the last 20 years who were also not just interested in pulling oil out, but concentrating protein. And the idea was, can we use more of these corn proteins in swine nutrition, in poultry nutrition? And what about the untapped markets of aquaculture and pets? And there have been a couple of dozen different approaches and technologies and companies that have tried one way or another to pull the fiber out, pull the protein out, send a clean starch stream into the fermenters because the starch is what the yeast need for their fermentation. Most of them went bankrupt over the last 20 years. And most of those technologies are not around. There's only a handful of technologies that just within the last 7 or 8 years really have come to the forefront. And they're all variations on the same thing, though. They're all, how do we use particle size or how do we use particle density and what kind of machines can we install to separate protein from fiber, from oil, from starch? And so we've got a handful of companies that are being quite successful. There are still questions. Is this going to revolutionize the industry? Is there enough demand for protein versus fiber? It's a challenge. The nutrition industry is, it's cost matters. And if you have an ingredient that is 10% lower in price for the same production practice or 10% higher in price for the same production practice, what you use matters.
Yes, it does.
It's never a dull moment. And if we pin it down today and say, this is the situation, in a month, it's going to be a little bit different. And 2 months from now, it's going to continue to be a little bit different. But at the moment, we have about a dozen companies, maybe a few more, that either have installed protein separation or they're planning on installing protein separation. But I'm going to backpedal for a second, and I am going to say, if you're a livestock nutritionist, what impacts you beyond price? Consistency. And if your ethanol plant is producing a DDG product, or you're a cattle feeder and you're purchasing a DDG product, if you know how to use that product because you've been using it for many years and it prices well into your ration, you don't want that composition to change. Because if that protein content goes down or that fiber content goes up, that's going to change the way you use it in your ration. So there is a very big role to play in traditional DDGS. And so I will say, in my estimation, that not every ethanol plant is going to install these. Like they installed the oil separators, I don't think every plant is going to install a $30 million bolt-on facility to make high protein, because the demand for the traditional product is still there.
Well, and certainly those of us who use it would hope that that product would be available. You know, when you talk about the good old days, back in the day, if somebody would have told us we'd feed this much fiber to a swine animal, we'd have thought they were crazy. But, you know, here we are today feeding some very high levels of DDGS to swine, and it seems to be working just fine, much against what popular opinion would have been 15 years ago. So now that we've adjusted to that and we like the product, just as you say, we do get concerned about it going away.
You know, it's interesting too, because when you talk to people in the renewable fuels industries or the livestock industries in Europe, for example, or other countries, in Europe, ethanol is not popular. What is popular is producing feed ingredients for beef, dairy, swine, and poultry. And that is the discussion. The discussion is not fuel. It's how do we produce more protein for our livestock?
Is that because there's not three pickup trucks in every driveway in Europe like there is in America? I mean, we consume a lot of fuel here.
We do. We've got a large population too, and we've got a lot of corn.
Yeah.
You know, what is this question about EVs and electrification going to do to the feed ingredient availability? I think it goes back to the benefit of feeding a DDG product versus a corn product, feeding just corn in your ration. I think there are benefits. Like you say, who would have thought that you'd be feeding high levels? And I don't know what levels you feed in your different age categories, but I know that some of the feeders that I've talked to in Iowa, it's incredible. Depending what the age is, you know, some, if it prices in, up to 50% of the ration for a while at least.
Yeah, in certain phases, yeah.
Like, holy cow. 20 years ago, they wouldn't go above 10%.
Well, and there's still some that won't, but yeah, it is unbelievable to me, having grown up in the feed mill business, how that has changed, and how it just goes to show you that sometimes long-held beliefs are not as accurate as maybe we thought they were when they were thought up, right? I mean,
yeah. Well, if the EV market does take off, and I don't know if I'm prepared for that myself, because my family lives about 4 hours away, and you know, personally, in the middle of winter, I don't want to stop and recharge when I'm going home for Christmas. So that might be a challenge in many parts of the country. But if it does go away, what does that mean for the demand for biofuels? And what does that mean for the supply of DDG or related products in our feed industry? I think those are questions we need to wrestle with sooner rather than later.
Well, listen, we'll take a minute here to thank the people that have tuned in, and we hope that you're picking up some much needed information or much appreciated. So if that's the case, why hit the like button. If you want to see some more of these, please subscribe. I think we've covered our three main questions here for sure. But could you just take just a second to tell us a little bit about anything that, you know, new for DDGs, or, you know, something we may not be even looking at yet that is quite possible?
You know, that's a great question. I think that it's not just DDGs that we have to think about, but I'm going to make a more expansive response, if that's all right. I'm going to talk about the next generation of people that are going to enter the workforce. Because, and this is true, I think, for the ethanol industry, but it's also true for the feed milling industry. How do we train people, and how do we get young people interested in this type of work? You know, I know this isn't exactly DDG, and I apologize, but these are the thoughts that I have because here at Iowa State, I teach a course on grain processing. I teach a course on ethanol processing. I teach a course on pet food processing. And, you know, there are students, but it seems like interest in these types of industries is not where it used to be. And, you know, we've got career fairs happening this week and the next couple of weeks, and companies are really scrambling to find talent. And, you know, the solution to talent is not just automation and sensors and replacing people, but actually recruiting young people to go into the industry. And, you know, it's really interesting when, you know, you talk to some of these college kids and they're very selective these days. And, you know, frankly, when I went into the industry, I was just grateful to have a job offer. And
right. You know, yes. Yeah.
I'll sweep the floor. I'll wash the dishes. I'll do whatever it takes. And, but not that way anymore. Young people have specific ideas in mind. And unfortunately, you can't be the boss of a company unless you start your own company. You got to work your way up because there's just so much to learn that you can't learn at college. And how can we convince students that, you know, the feed industry, really, it's a field of opportunities for young people. And learning, and I guess I'm kind of blessed here at Iowa State because we have a new feed mill and a new grain science center. And it's really great to take students, not just to tour like I do with student groups, but to actually do hands-on things in the feed mill and actually run a roller mill or a hammer mill or a mixer or a pellet mill and actually see it and touch it and feel it and smell it and, oh, put your dust mask on because it's dusty.
Yeah, we got ag in our blood as kids, right, growing up in the dirt and the dust and around animals and stuff. And that, I don't think young people have that opportunity anymore because of, you know, the fewer number of farms that are out there. So we see the same thing. You know, we try to hire mill managers or, you know, even get somebody in a management training program in a feed mill. Very difficult to find somebody that is interested in that. And I think it's because they haven't been exposed to it.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And I know that with less than 2% of the nation's population involved in production ag, it's the populations are centering in the cities. And I remember when I was in FFA in high school, one of my speech contest presentations was about the rural exodus. And all of those years ago, people were worried about depopulation of rural areas. And it's been a slow and steady thing, but it has been a thing and it's not changing.
Yeah, agreed.
Although agritourism is interesting, it has totally nothing to do with DDG, but I've just seen some things on social media that you can be a rancher for a day or you can be a farmer for a week. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I don't know. Not me.
I think the feed industry, I think the ethanol industry, and, you know, with all the new soy plants coming online in the next couple of years, there's a huge demand for people that not just can operate the machines, but understand what it is they're doing. You know, if you're at an ethanol plant, it's really important to understand how do you do the processes correctly, because it's not just about making alcohol. It's about making high quality, consistent quality DDG or other feed products. And I think a comment you made a few minutes ago about, you know, nobody had expected that we would be feeding these high levels. Well, it's taken a lot of effort by a lot of nutritionists and research studies to get us to this point. There's still so many questions we don't know. And especially with some of the new species, aquaculture is not growing very fast in the U.S., unfortunately. And even though we have a lot of potential in the U.S., but overseas, it is growing exponentially. And I think there's still room, a lot of room, to understand how do you use traditional DDG as well as some of these high protein products? What's the best way to use them? And I would contend it's not good enough to say we can achieve equivalent performance. You need better performance. You need a lower cost of production. And just like all of the other animal industries, It's not about let's substitute one for another and hope we have equivalents. You got to have cost reduction and improve performance.
And that changes the whole feed mill business, right? Because we've always in the past, we just used assumed values for ingredients. That's not true anymore. You need to know your DDGS. You need to do wet labs. And because DDGS is not DDGS is not DDGS. So you have to understand it. And then we pellet our feed. Man, you talk about a learning curve. You know, you start putting in high DDGs and want to pellet it to boot. So this whole thing has had a ripple effect, you know, through the whole industry and challenged how we pellet and how we grind and how we store feed, even, you know, flowability. It's really had a huge effect on the feed industry for sure.
Yeah, good luck with the pelleting.
We can do it.
But it's not easy. You got to know what you're doing.
That's right. You have to, and you have to have people that want to understand the process. You can't automate everything, and you got to have somebody that understands whether you're pelleting or grinding or whatever you're doing. As you said, you have to have people that understand it, that can, if they're doing it for a while and all of a sudden it stops happening, then they got to be able to figure out why and get back to it. And those are the people that's hard to find.
I would also say it's really important if you use DDG or any of the protein products or whatever product you're purchasing, and it's not just ethanol products, it's any ingredient, understand what you're buying. And a certificate of analysis is not good enough. I think, you know, it's standard practice for most ingredient manufacturers. Here's our feed tag. Well, if it's a guaranteed above a certain level or guaranteed below a certain level, you really need more information than the tag. You really need to understand exactly what it is. And does that mean that your feed mill should have an online NIR system testing all the inbound ingredients? Maybe.
Yeah.
Because you're right. It's not just one plant versus another plant's ingredients. It's also changes over time at a single supplier.
You can't just buy the cheapest DDG per ton. You need to know what the value of that DDG is.
Exactly. And I will also say something that y'all might want to be aware of is even if you're buying your DDG from a specific ethanol supplier, and there are conglomerators that will blend DDG from lots of different ethanol plants, and that's especially true in terms of the export market, but it's also true in the domestic market. That's especially important. But if you're buying from a single plant, you're probably going to have better luck. But the enzymes that are being used are changing the structure and the functionality of the components of the DDG. For example, most ethanol plants are using different cocktails of enzymes now to access more starch. So residual starch in the DDG is going down because of better fermentation. But part of that story is the proteases that are being used. And those are changing, which, depending on what supplier you use for your enzymes and what levels they use, that's also going to impact the functionality of the fiber, not just in the animal, but also how that fiber is potentially going to bind with other things in the pellet mill, for example. So I think it's important to monitor your composition for all of your inbound ingredients and not just rely on your feed tag.
I agree 100%.
Oh, I hate to say precision nutrition, but I mean, really, that's where we're at. We're entering that realm.
Well, and margins and so forth force you to do that, right? I mean, we're not back in the old days. One time when I grew up, our marketing strategy was when it rained and it was too wet to do anything else, we shipped hogs to town, right? You can't operate that way anymore. Just can't do it.
Ship hogs or clean the shop.
Yeah. And so there's been a lot of change. And I think your point is well put that there's going to be more.
Yeah.
We've not gotten to the end yet of DDGS or any other ingredient, quite honestly.
Even soybean meal is changing. It's slower, but it is still changing, especially with these new plants coming on board. I think it's going to be really important that whatever ingredient you're using, know what you're buying. And use that information to help make better choices.
Well, have we covered most of the things you wanted to talk about today?
Absolutely, but I could talk for hours. So
you have a standing invitation to come back and do another episode with us if you'd like. That's not a problem.
All right. Well, that sounds fantastic. I would like that very much.
It's time for our famous three. Evonik Animal Nutrition is committed to ensure food security and safety while reducing the ecological footprint of animal farming. Its products and services use evidence-based solutions that seek to promote animal welfare and reduce reliance on natural resources. All this is underpinned by long-standing industry partnerships and deep customer understanding. Evonik's focus on efficiency, sustainable, healthy nutrition, and collaborations with livestock farming partners creates value for customers and consumers.
Well, if you don't mind, I have three questions I'd like to ask you that we just ask. I ask all the guests.
This is dangerous.
Well, it's not too bad. So the first thing I ask is, you know, do you have a book or, you know, kind of what's your go-to reference for things, you know, within, let's say, the subject of DDGS? Do you have a go-to reference?
I do. And it's starting to get a bit old, but back in my USDA days, I wrote a book on DDG, and it's still the only DDG book out there. Is Distiller's Grains, Production Properties and Utilization. But it wasn't just me. I was editor of the book. But I had a team of nutritionists from around the U.S. contribute chapters in terms of what was the state of knowledge in terms of beef, dairy, swine, poultry, fish, but then other uses for DDG like bioenergy and bioplastics and stuff like that. But that is my go-to reference. Even though it's the material starting to get a bit dated and I need to get an update of that book underway, that is for me where I go when I need a quick answer.
Well, and you can humbly say at this time, that's the best book on the subject. In existence, right?
Well, it's the only book on the subject.
Agreed. Okay, so question number two then, what is your favorite resource or book, you know, outside of DDGs, personally?
I would say probably my go-to reference is the Feed Manufacturing Handbook that AFIA publishes. And I know they've gone to an online version for their latest incarnation, but I'm looking at my shelf and I've got four different volumes sitting there from over the last few decades. And I have used so much material because it's written by so many experts in the field. And so that for me is my go-to for any question related to processing.
And that's a good organization. So last question then, in your opinion, in agriculture, what sets, you know, the successful person apart from those that are not so successful?
Are you sure I only have a few minutes?
Hey, we got guys at work, they edit for a living. So you just tell us what you want to tell us.
People are not going to do stuff for you. You got to do it yourself and you got to self-motivate yourself. You got to have gumption. And a lot of things in life are not going to be easy, so you got to have the grit to see them through. If they're worth doing, do them well, do them right, but you got to motivate yourself to do it. So that's sort of my MO, and you can even ask my students. They ask me to take my foot off the accelerator for some reason. I don't know why, but the real world isn't like that.
It is not, no. I think that was great advice. So if you'll hold on just a minute here, I'd like to, thank our viewers again for joining us. So at this time, we'll conclude this episode. If you saw something here you liked, share it with a friend. Come back and see us. Wisenetics will be bringing you more of these feed science podcasts, and you don't want to miss any of those episodes. So for now, Bob Odker saying thank you and goodbye, and God bless you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.